ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It's one of Australia's most baffling unsolved missing persons cases. In 2007, four people, including a five-year-old girl, vanished in Western Australia amid rumours of bizarre behaviour, cults, and long-hidden secrets.
Yep, we're trying to track them down.
I'm Dominique Bayens, and I've been investigating for the new season of Expanse, The Nan Up 4. Search Expanse on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor, and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. Everything as old is new again, eventually, even our clothes. Frugal chic, secondhand shopping, and buy nothing new movements are having a moment, which should be a plus when you consider how much Australia contributes to textile waste globally. But if all this consuming less is just part of the fashion cycle, how long can we expect it to last? If dialing back the environmental impact of our clothes is important to us, how do we ensure frugality is not just a flash in the pan? That's in the next 20 minutes. Also ahead, if I were to say peaches and apricots, would you know which jingle I was about to launch into? Earworms and advertising coming up here on ABC Radio National. But first, it doesn't feel like that long ago that zero alcohol drinks were a niche offering. Now the category has exploded. There's an ever-growing range of products taking up more shelf space in bottle shops and also in the supermarket drinks aisle. These drinks are marketed as a smart alternative for people looking to cut back on alcohol, but new research suggests alcohol brands may be using zero alcohol products, along with nutrition claims like low carb or low sugar, to blur the line between drinking and healthy living, particularly for young people. So should these products be more tightly controlled, or are we getting into nanny state territory? Isn't it good enough that we have zero alcohol alternatives at all? I want to hear from you. Would you serve a zero alcohol beer to your kid or grandkids? Should these drinks be sold at the supermarket? What's the place for zero alcohol beverages? With me is Professor Simone Pettigrew, Head of Food Policy at the George Institute for Global Health, and Dee Madigan, Creative Director in Advertising, who you might know from the ABC TV show Gruen. Welcome to you both. Simone, I might start with you. Take me through this new research that's just been published around zero alcohol drinks.
Good morning, Tegan. We have been looking at the way in which these zero alcohol products are appearing in both alcohol stores and in supermarkets. And we're particularly interested in the supermarket evolution because that has been a previously protected domain where we didn't see alcohol brands present. And that's a good thing because obviously you've got a lot of children wandering around supermarkets. So when we looked at what's on shelf in both of those types of outlets, we found that actually there's still quite small proportions of the products that are available. So for instance, in alcohol stores, it was around 3% of all the products that were on shelf that categorised as zero alcohol and about 2% in the supermarkets. And you might think, well, actually, isn't it more than that? I've seen so much zero alcohol advertising. Surely it's huge. And perhaps some of those brands are selling quite a bit of per capita volume. But overall, they're a tiny part of the market. So they're really not a fix yet to Australians' love of alcohol. And what we found in the supermarkets is that increasingly those products categorized as zero alcohol that are available are the big alcohol brands. So previously, those big, famous, popular alcohol brands constituted around one third of those products. It's getting up closer now to two thirds. And that's a real concern if young people are wandering up and down the aisles, and they're often in the soft drink aisles where young children would go past. And there they're seeing those big brands that we've been trying to protect them from in that context.
Isn't it a good thing to have a zero alcohol version of something, though? Isn't it sort of helping destigmatize sobriety? Is that not something worth promoting?
Absolutely. And we call that the substitution effect when people drink these products instead of their usual alcohol consumption. And we're all for that. Anything that reduces alcohol consumption is a really good thing because alcohol is responsible for around 200 different kinds of diseases. It's a class one carcinogen. It's responsible for about 7 different types of cancer. So reducing alcohol intake is absolutely great. But the evidence to date is suggesting that while some people are using zero alcohol products to substitute for alcohol, others are using them in addition. So, for instance, they'll tell us, well, normally I wouldn't drink alcohol on a weeknight, but now I pop these zero alcohol products in the fridge and I can have them all week instead. And while that might sound harmless, they also tell us that their teenagers in the house then see those beverages and are asking to consume them.
So perhaps it's a gateway there. Dee, what do you make of this idea that alcohol brands are using zero alcohol products to promote themselves?
I don't think they're probably doing it deliberately. Maybe that's being nice to alcohol brands. You know, I do think whoever invented cruises was definitely going for teenagers, no doubt about it. I think they're seeing an opportunity for expanding their market and to be able to advertise legitimately. And unlike vapes, which I absolutely think tobacco companies used and then sold as an alternative to get people to stop smoking, but we knew it acted as a gateway, I think we are in danger of, regardless of their intent, that the unintended consequences on teenagers might be problematic. So we want the harm reduction benefits. We do not want to be creating a new marketing channel. And we know that's how branding works. You know, when they see it all the time, it normalises it for them. So I do think there are very important conversations to be had about where and when teenagers see this. Because, okay, so years ago, LG Fridges launched this campaign for these $40,000 fridges that no one could afford to buy. And they knew that. And it wasn't the purpose of the campaign, but the purpose of the campaign was to sell the brand. Mm. And the danger is that this might be doing the same thing. And we grew up with able to buy, you know, VB T-shirts at Target and Kmart and stuff. And the cricket was sponsored by cigarettes. And we know the long-term harm of all that in terms of normalising these brands in teenagers' minds was extremely problematic. So whether they did it intentionally or not kind of isn't the point. It's that it's definitely something we need to make sure there are no unintended consequences from it.
Right. So, Simone, a lot of this conversation is focused on young people. Correct me if I'm wrong, that sort of seems to be the core anxiety here. What are the rules around serving a zero alcohol beer to a minor?
Yes, we are primarily concerned with young people. The number one rule is always look after the kids. And at the moment, legally, they can purchase these zero alcohol products. The major supermarket chains are doing a really good job of self-regulating and saying, no, we are not going to sell these products to minors. We would really like to see that formalised and to become a mandatory requirement across all retail outlets. As Dee said, we just need to make sure that kids aren't getting access to these things because those brands do permeate their conscious and their subconscious. But also, I'm sure many listeners can remember the first time they tried beer, for instance, and it's a bit icky. If they're starting these products younger and building up a palate, a taste formation for them earlier, then it's very likely that's going to result in earlier initiation of the real thing.
You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, chatting with Professor Simone Pettigrew from the George Institute for Global Health and Dee Madigan, Creative Director at Campaign Edge, who you might know from Gruen on TV. We're talking about zero alcohol drinks being more and more available in supermarket settings and whether that is perhaps a problem in terms of these brands getting their face in front of young people especially. I'm asking you how you feel about zero alcohol drinks in supermarkets. Would you serve zero alc beers to your kids or grandkids? One person says, zero alcohol, absolutely brilliant. I haven't touched alcohol for 4 years. The best brands taste like beer, smell like beer, but with none of the downsides. Marshall says, I found a non-alcohol beer that tastes like beer. I choose not to take alcohol. So two pros there. One person though says, seems to me zero alcohol is to alcohol what non-nicotine vaping is to cigarettes. So no, shouldn't be in supermarkets or for kids. Simone, talking about supermarkets as a setting, there are a lot of things sold in supermarkets that are not good for us. Why are you homing in on this particular category?
Yeah, well, alcohol is different and there are a whole bunch of science around the fact that alcohol is no ordinary commodity. And again, listeners can't be blamed for being confused about that because when you look at the advertising of alcohol, it's fun, it's social, it tastes great. You know, you do it with all your friends. There's nothing there communicating the fact that this is actually a toxin versus virtually everything else that you can buy that you can consume orally in a supermarket. it's not a toxin in and of itself. Instead, it builds up incrementally over time. So unhealthy food, for instance, you know, if you have some of that, it's not such a problem. But every mouthful of alcohol is a problem for your health. It increases your health risks. The WHO, the World Health Organization, says there is absolutely no safe dose of alcohol because when you consume alcohol, it converts to aldehyde in the body, which negatively affects your DNA. Now, that's something that people aren't aware of. And what we would really like is that people do become more aware of that and they can manage their own risk once they're advised of the true risks versus all of this kind of lovely advertising making alcohol out just to be one of those other products on the supermarket shelf when actually it's not.
Well, even though we are talking about zero alcohol alternatives, we are talking about the alcohol industry. So I've invited Alistair Coe, Executive Director of Alcohol Beverages Australia, on to respond to some of this research. Alistair, are alcohol brands using zero alcohol products as a Trojan horse to the real thing?
Good morning. Good to be with you. Well, at the outset, it's important to recognise that the reason we are having this discussion is because Australians are embracing moderation. Consumption is at record lows. Risky drinking continues to fall markedly. Yet Australians are still enjoying our world-class products. So it's really important that we always look at the evidence, particularly the evidence about consumption, when we're making these sorts of decisions and having these sorts of discussions.
So is this a pivot from the alcohol industry to remain profitable then if people are turning away from alcohol?
Well, there's no doubt that Australians want more choice with regard to their drinks. And the alcohol industry is providing low and mid options, but increasingly we're seeing zero alcohol products, which is a great option for many people. But the statistics are really quite significant. For instance, you were talking earlier about underage drinking. Well, underage drinking 20 years ago was about 70% of the population. Now it's down to 30% and continues to fall. So there is real progress being made right across the board, but particularly amongst young people.
Simone, how does that track with your research looking at drinking behaviour in Australians?
That's spot on, but you can put a different lens on that. So if you do have this shrinking of alcohol consumption amongst those youth segments, then that's a problem for the alcohol industry because that's their sales today, but also their sales in the future. So it's critically important for the alcohol industry to tap back into that group. They can't let them fade away. So zero alcohol products are assisting with that process. And when we've surveyed teenagers, they'll actually tell us, they have done this on numerous occasions, that they think zero alcohol products are designed for them. And they often nominate both teenagers, pregnant people and drivers as the three main categories of people for whom zero alcohol products are targeted. So the industry might say they're not trying to target that group, but it's certainly getting through to them.
On the text line, you're telling me your thoughts this morning. One says, selling zero alcohol on the supermarket shelves at reasonable prices is good. To remove them would be ridiculous. Teenagers can get alcohol via many different means, but yes, best not to allow them to buy zeros if underage. Greg says, I can understand the logic about kids continuing on to harder stuff because of the power of the brand, but doesn't the logic break down as it's illegal to sell or supply alcohol to kids under 18? Gav says, this is getting ridiculous. How about we just ban teenagers and the rest of us can get on with our lives? Simone, where does this become overreach?
Yeah, you had a good variety of responses there. The overreach claim, I guess, would apply if we're looking at doing something that's really abnormal. But not having alcohol brands in Australia was the norm. Until relatively recently, kids could wander around a supermarket without being exposed to those brands. We'd just like to see a reversion back to that situation, or at the very least, and quite simply, those products could be taken away from the soft drink aisle, popped somewhere back in the supermarket where they are not going to be so clearly obvious to young people.
In the fruit and veggie section, put them there. The young people are not going there.
Yeah, Dee, from a marketing perspective, what would your advice be if you're trying to sort of straddle the line between providing alternatives and allowing things that are currently legal and with this social mind at play as well?
Yeah, look, it's tricky. We know that placement matters. And I think that two things. One, maybe the branding should be more visually distinctive. from the alcohol versions, but I think placing them in an area of the supermarket where teenagers don't necessarily go is probably a good idea. The other thing we need to be very careful of at the moment, if I'm advertising for an alcohol brand, there are really, really strict rules on what can happen in the ad and who can feature in the ad. Those rules won't actually apply, I don't think, to the non-alcohol, to the low alcohol or no alcohol versions of it. And I think we need to be very, very careful that we don't all of a sudden see a proliferation of those kind of ads that'll essentially be a really good brand job in a very detrimental way to teenagers. So that's something we need to be super, super careful of. And also just back to the 30% of teenagers. That's still 30% of people drinking alcohol when their brains are literally rewiring themselves. It's still too high. I mean, yes, it's getting better, but let's not pretend that, you know, it's good. It's not.
Simone, there's a couple of papers out today. There's the one that we've just spoken about the proportion of drinks available. You're also an author on one about the marketing around alcoholic drinks with the idea of low carb or calorie labels. Why are you concerned about that kind of marketing?
Yeah, so one of the playbook strategies of harmful industries is to distract people from the harmful component of the product, in this case, which is the alcohol. So we're now seeing this proliferation of claims, nutrient claims, health claims on products, things like, you know, low sugar, low carb, 86 calories, gluten-free. And it's so ironic because as we've seen in the food sector, often those claims are on products, for instance, that would never have gluten in the first place. But the industry knows, and we know from a lot of research, that it's really effective. It creates this halo effect where people get distracted from the negatives and focus on this one single positive. And they're more likely then to think the product is healthy and more likely to want to buy it. And that kind of distraction, unfortunately, we're seeing on steroids. If you think about like billboards at stations, on the sides of trams, when they've got those enormous alcohol ads, those claims can be 6 foot high. They're enormous. So they're really in your face. There are lots of them out there. We know they mislead people. And they're often, again, saying things that are not appropriate for that particular product category. We found a product that had 9 claims on the packaging. I mean, it's just getting out of control. And then there are also some of what are considered illegal claims that the regulator would not approve. And they're things like protein in this drink and collagen in this drink. And that really is taking a lend. So we certainly need some better monitoring and enforcement of those kinds of claims that are appearing on products.
Alistair, do you agree with the idea that this is perhaps a disingenuous way to be promoting products that we know are innately harmful?
Look, I'll come back to that in just a moment, but just to follow up on Dee's comment with regard to the very strict regulatory environment that we have in Australia for alcohol advertising, it is worth noting that this same environment also includes zero alcohol beer. So the same rules that you have for advertising beer also applies for advertising zero beer. But with regard to the claims that are made, health ministers across Australia came together last year to consider this very issue, led by Food Standards Australia, and they were guided by evidence which said that these claims don't actually have an impact on the level of consumption. So whilst they might have an impact as to what product people choose, they don't make an impact as to whether people have alcohol or not.
Simone, have you seen this in your work?
Yeah, I'd just like to make a couple of comments there. I think, for one, it's blatantly untrue to say a very strict advertising environment in terms of regulation, because there is a voluntary code that not all alcohol providers have signed up to. So, and the other problem there, of course, is that even though it mentions zero alcohol products, it actually allows them to be exempt from certain conditions of the code. So what was just communicated was not correct. So I think
Add to that as well, is you've got situations like where Bundaberg rum combined with Bundaberg ginger beer, two different companies, to come up with an alcohol product. But Bundaberg ginger beer can still advertise as they want. We've got a new product that's come out overseas that will be coming here, which is Jack Daniels and Coca-Cola, the brand Coca-Cola. Now, that Coca-Cola can still advertise exactly how they want, and that's still going to impact on how teenagers see then that combined brand with Jack Daniels.
Interesting. On the text line, you're telling me what you think. One person says, on selling zero alcohol drinks in supermarkets, Danny says, do you really want to ask an alcoholic to visit a bottle shop to purchase zero alcohol beers? Another says, as someone who's had issues with alcohol, I think that not having to go into a bottle shop is a key consideration. Of course, having zero alcohol drinks in the supermarket is helpful. And Paul says, rather than seeing zero alcohol as a gateway, maybe it's better to see it as an exit strategy for the binge drinking culture in Australia. Simone, I know that what you're asking for is more regulations, but do we risk putting vulnerable people at harm if we regulate these too tightly?
The evidence is really mixed around how zero alcohol products can help or perhaps exacerbate the situation for people with alcohol dependency. Some seem to be able to use them quite well as a replacement, but others find it very triggering, the smell, the taste, and it can be a risk for then going back to drinking full alcohol. So that needs to be kept in mind. But also, I mean, these days you don't need to walk into an alcohol store to buy a zero alcohol product. You can order online. There are certainly ways around that.
Well, thank you all so much for sharing your insights today. I really do appreciate it. Professor Simone Pettigrew, Head of Food Policy at the George Institute for Global Health, Dee Madigan, Creative Director at Campaign Edge. You probably know her from the ABC TV show Gruen, and Alistair Coe, Executive Director of Alcohol Beverages Australia. And you've given me such food for thought on the text line as well. Joe in Melbourne says, I've been partaking in the zero low alcohol beers lately, and I'm gravitating towards them as my drink of choice in social settings. So I welcome more choice in this part of the sector. Well, there's always been a couple of products in the supermarket that are zero alcohol. I noticed they're expanding in the soft drink aisle. I've got young kids, and there's real debate in our house when they ask what's the drink I'm sipping on and if they can try. There's an uneasiness given we're hardline on our kids being too young to even sip an alcoholic beer or wine to try. We've landed on no on trying non-alcoholic beers, and as a result, want them confined to alcohol retailers. Well, stick with me here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Coming up next, have you ever sworn off spending for a while? I want to know what you got out of it.
Global roaming is expanding to keep pace with your world.
Because keeping up can be a challenge.
And events can feel overwhelming beyond our understanding.
What might Xi Jinping do next?
What hand is Trump hiding?
Join me, Hamish McDonald, Geraldine Doogue, Latika Burke and Kylie Morris.
Four voices bringing perspective, experience and energy to the big global stories.
Global roaming, weekdays at 11 on ABC Radio National and ABC Listen.
If I described the outfit I'm wearing right now as chic, and the beauty of radio is that you can't fact check me on this, what kind of vision springs to mind? And how does that vision change if I instead described it as frugal chic? If you chuck that phrase into Instagram Reels, you'll see people trying low or no buy experiments, curbing their impulse to buy more clothes. The idea is to save money and the environment too. And Australians are among the highest consumers of textiles per capita in the world. We buy an average of 55 garments per year, and more than 150 million of those garments end up in landfill. So with stats like that, it's hard to imagine any other reasonable solution aside from never buying anything ever, ever again. But how realistic is that? And with so many of last year's trends already on the clothes garbage heap, would stopping now make much of a difference? I do want to hear from you. Have you ever tried a no spending spree to reassess your wardrobe? I'd love to know what you got out of it. You will hear in a second from someone who is spearheading a movement all about buying nothing new. But first, Dr. Lorinda Kramer is a social and cultural historian at Deakin University who explores sustainable fashion and waste. Lorinda, welcome.
Hello, Tegan. It's really great to be with you.
So you've been exploring fashion trends as part of your research. Where does this frugal chic term come from?
Yes. So it's, as you've mentioned, it's a term that's been trending in recent months on social media, Instagram, TikTok and the like. It was coined by Mia McGrath. She's a social media content creator, and she uses it to refer to a careful, mindful approach to spending that blends frugal habits with a handful of classic, well-made investment pieces. And what she's trying to encourage is a sense of what she calls underconsumption as a kind of antidote to what she sees as a current context of overconsumption. But what she's actually promoting isn't an end to shopping altogether. She's suggesting a balance by cutting back in particular areas. So some examples could be not buying a coffee at a cafe every day, or using plain makeup and skincare rather than expensive brands. She then suggests that this opens up the potential for some more luxurious purposes. And this is the chic component of her frugal chic concept. And you'll have noticed from that brief description that McGrath, she isn't talking only about clothes, though I think its application of clothing is an interesting one. And this is really what's captured my thinking around this frugal chic concept. So what it does, she encourages intentional clothing purchases, alert to items that could form what she refers to as a forever wardrobe. And so she's encouraging us to invest in quality, saying that we should buy it nice or buy it twice. So it's about mindful consumption over mindless consumption, and about reassessing ingrained habits and also against pushing back the idea that more is better.
That's lovely, Lorinda, but it feels very familiar. Like, this isn't just one person's thing. I'm thinking about capsule wardrobes. I'm thinking about, like, French chic. This sort of, it feels like it's part of the same fashion cycle that we're seeing in the more consumptive parts of fashion.
Tegan, you're so right. So we've seen elements of this, you know, time and time again. You mentioned capsule wardrobes, and I think that they do something very similar. They're the idea that you can buy a handful of good quality garments. These are often in neutral colours as staples, and these can be worn together interchangeably. You can add bold accent pieces. So it does something very similar. It suggests a smaller wardrobe, but that also can be framed as a responsible wardrobe choice. There's also movements like the slow fashion movement. This has been around for a while now, and it is a global movement that supports people to, as the name suggests, slow down clothing purchases. What the slow fashion movement is driven by is this awareness of environmental and societal impacts of the purchases we make. So thinking about the many people, materials, processes that go into making garments well before they even find their way into our wardrobe. And part of that movement that I find really fascinating is the encouragement for us to form a different and a deeper relationship with our clothes, to consider them as more than just kind of material goods that we purchase at one moment in time and throw out at another moment, but actually that we do have this relationship to what we wear, that these clothes can hold memories, they can hold emotions, they can remind us of people and places. And I really love that part of the slow fashion movement.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, talking with Dr. Lorinda Kramer, who's at Deakin University. We're talking about frugal chic, the latest trend when it comes to buying less. I'm asking you if you have considered pulling back on your spending, if you've learned something from that. Pamela says, I buy 90% secondhand, but it's the second part of her text that has lit off something in my brain. I never buy online after 9 p.m. Pamela, that is a rule I'm going to instate for myself. Andrea says, to have forever clothing, I'd have to have a forever body. Great point. Well, also here with me is Tamara Dimatina. She's been at the forefront of a counter-consumption campaign for the past couple of decades as the founder of Buy Nothing New Month. Tamara, I've heard about this on and off over the past couple of decades. How did your original Buy Nothing experiment begin?
Firstly, Tegan, thanks for having me. I started Buy Nothing New for myself out of financial necessity. So it was, I love saying this, it was at the turn of the century, so nearly 25 years ago. I was living in London and I was working at a posh auction house called Sotheby's, and I had to look super smart for work, but I couldn't afford to. I was a temp, I wasn't earning much money, but I had to turn up and look really smart. And so I started op shopping, or charity store shopping back then. I went and bought myself a secondhand sewing machine on eBay that had just launched, this interesting new online experiment of selling things. And I started making stuff for myself so that I could turn up to work properly. But back then, I felt really ashamed. I used to look around to make sure no one was seeing me going into the op shops. I wasn't doing it from a place of strength and joy. Mm. Whereas now I kind of feel I never go and buy anything new now. Like, I only shop in op shops, and I feel very proud that it's kind of like activism that you can wear, and it's a way that every day you can start conversations with people around how can we all be part of solutions to a whole chunk of the problems that we can see on the planet. I love buying nothing new. I try to only buy in charity stores. I can find the best quality things. I find them way cheaper than if I was buying, you know, at that same price point in just an everyday store. So for me, it ticks so many boxes. I love fashion. I can look really smart. I can save money and I can help the community, and it's much better for the planet. So for me, it's just such an excellent way to address so many challenges that we all see in the world. But it's been a really long journey for me. So I started doing my own sort of buy nothing new 25 years ago. But in 2010, I went to Antarctica and I learned about climate change. And it really opened my eyes up to so many of the issues that I hadn't really been aware of. I'd always been very aware of waste. I remember when I was a kid, mum and dad, you know, I'd be in the back of the car at night, we'd be driving around and I'd look into the shops and the lights would be on and I used to think, why are the lights on? What a waste. Like no one's around, no one's shopping. And all that stuff, where did it come from and where does it go? But then I kind of just got on with life and didn't, all of those questions that I had in the early years went to the back of my mind until, you know, they started becoming noisier in my mind. I went to Dharavi, the slums in Mumbai in 2009. I saw people really valuing the waste from the West. To them, it was a resource. And that really, I do remember a moment where someone picked up, it was, I think, just a plastic bottle on the side of the road. And I remember going, they are picking that up and they're going to, that's a resource for them. That's whether it's going to feed them or their family today. But then, as I said, the next year going to Antarctica really made me go, wow. I became aware of the impact we were having on our beautiful planet. And I thought, how do I be part of the solution? And having been questioning in my head for such a long time, why are we being so wasteful? Why are we such a consumer world? And how can we look at the alternatives that are better for our people, better for our planet, better for our pockets, better for our pets? Like for me, buying nothing new, it doesn't say spend no money month. Buy nothing new month is around how can we look at the alternatives? How can you get the thing that you need? And I think that's a really important distinction.
Yeah,
that's what's the difference between what we need and what we want, and how can we get that in a way that can be regenerative and help our communities rather than extractive and taking resources out of, you know, often it's in other countries where people are being paid so poorly so we can have more cheap T-shirts in all the colourways. Yeah. I think it's just a beautiful way to sort of even out the ledger.
Getting that circular economy going. You're buying less, buying well. Liz said, when I had my children, I only bought one new outfit per year up to a value of $500. I'm now 75 years old and I still follow this rule. Works well for me. Nick in Hobart says, I've been op shopping for 40 years. For the last 20, my only new items have been socks, jocks, two pairs of shoes, one dress shirt, one tie, and one T-shirt. I have a huge wardrobe from secondhand and am known as a sharp dresser. Nick finishes by saying, luckily, my weight is very stable. Greg R. says, I buy a lot of secondhand clothes, so it's frugal, but never chic. I'm still my daggy self. Lorinda, I want to know about these trends that we sort of talked about before. How effective are they in influencing us towards buying less or buying more sustainably?
Look, I think, Tegan, that they all have a part to play. And I've been so interested to hear Tamara's take on buying less and the process that she follows. And actually, everyone who's texting into, these are all such fantastic things to hear more about. We now have Australia's Clothing Stewardship Scheme, Seamless, who are taking figures year by year. And we've had figures from 2023 and 2024 since their launch in 2023 come through. We actually know that the number of new clothes purchased between those 2 years, there was a slight uptick, which is quite troubling. There has also been an uptick in buying from op shops, for example, that I know so many people do. So how effective these are, I think we still need possibly a few more years to really get a sense of what they're doing, how they are changing our habits. One of the things that I think concerns me most about this is that we need to make sure that we're targeting particular groups. And we know that groups respond in very different ways. So, for example, one of Seamless's primary pillars is education. But how do we educate, for example, Gen Zs? That's a very different group to educate than somebody like me, for example. So I think we probably need to wait a little bit longer. But in my eyes, I think all of these rallying cries for more sustainable, more mindful consumption are worth it. My hope is that in some way they will all build on, intersect with each other, and that a difference will be made.
Tamara, it struck me that a lot of your fashion, your exploits that you were describing before, you've gone out, you're scouring up shops, you're making things yourself, you're altering them, sounds gorgeous. It also sounds really time consuming, and that you need a certain level of skill to be able to do that. Is the sort of lifestyle that you're promoting actually a realistic option for a lot of people?
I reckon that's a great question. I think most of us have heard that quote, and it's always incorrectly attributed. So I don't know actually who said it in the first place, but that advertising has us, I think it's like working jobs that we hate to buy stuff we don't need with money we don't have to impress people we don't like.
I think Abraham Something Lincoln like said it.
Hey?
People always say Abraham Lincoln. I'm reckoning Abraham
Lincoln. Oh, right. I remember it from Fight Club. But wherever it came from, I think it's a great place to start with that. This crazy consumer treadmill does have put so much pressure on us to have stuff that we don't necessarily need or to look a certain way. I think the way that I shop, I feel like I've got much more time on my hands because I save so much money buying this way. I'm very lucky. I know I live in an inner city area where I'm really close to a whole lot of op shops, so it's easy for me to do it. I'm not driving out to I think the last time I went to a big box shopping centre was probably about 15 years ago, and I drove around for about 45 minutes trying to get a park, and I left with nothing empty-handed because it was just such a horrible experience. So I feel like you can actually save a lot of time when you rethink how are we consuming. So I do save a lot of money. The things that I'm buying probably at quarter of the price, but buying really good quality things. Shopping is not a pastime for me. I think for a lot of people, they might go and spend time on their weekends in the shopping centre. I don't spend that time there. I feel like I gain that time. But I also, I would love to see more homes having a sewing machine in them. There's, with very minimal skill, you can completely change your wardrobe with, as I said, hardly any skill. I have a whole lot of jackets that I used to wear. I still love them. But as you sort of, as you age, as a few of the texters have mentioned, like either weight or body shape changing, I've discovered the most simple way I can just put a panel, I literally cut the jacket up the back, sew down. It is the most easy thing you could possibly imagine doing. It requires no skill. And all of a sudden I've got a new jacket. So can you picture what I'm talking about? You literally sew a panel of an interesting different fabric down the back of the jacket. So you can gain an extra inch in the jacket or an extra 2 inches. Every time I wear one of those jackets, a stranger will stop me in the street and say, oh, my God, I love your jacket. Where did you get it?
And you're like, I made it, which is, there's nothing better than that feeling. We are coming short on time. Lorinda, briefly, what do you hope that people take away from conversations like this?
What I would love people to do is just pause, I think, before they make their purchasing decisions. Just think about, is this something that will last me longer than just a few months or even a few years? I would love for people to think about how they can form those deeper relationships with their clothes in order to wear them, possibly across a decade or more.
Well, thank you both so much for chatting with me today, Dr. Lorinda Kramer, social and cultural historian at Deakin University, exploring sustainable fashion and waste, and Tamara Dimatina, founder of Buy Nothing New Month and The New Joneses. If you like this chat, you should definitely check out, there's an ABC RN podcast from a couple of years back called Threads, hosted by Veronica Milsom. Tamara was part of that conversation too, so just search for Threads on ABC Listen. Coming up next, the secret formula behind those advertising jingles you still can't get out of your head decades on.
They're driven, distinctive, and brilliant.
I love doing it because it's a great discipline.
Creative Types is back for a new season, delving into the minds of some of our most creative Australians.
Yeah, a ridiculous amount of fun.
They wanted to share an emotion or share a story.
Fantastic.
Like Hugo Weaving, Andrea Lamb, and Andy Griffiths. The new season of Creative Types with me, Virginia Trioli.
There's lyrics in here that I don't want anybody to ever see. Mm-hmm.
Starts Thursday, March 5, 8:30 p.m. on ABC TV and ABC iView.
We've all been there. There's a song that pops into your head. It's like a line or a melody, and suddenly you're humming it without even thinking. But earworms aren't always innocent. Advertisers have long understood the power of music. A catchy jingle can build brand recognition in seconds, and long after we've seen the ad, the tune lingers, and with it, the product. So could the soundtrack in your head be shaping more of your decisions than you realise? And does the emergence of AI music present new challenges here? I want to hear from you about the song that you can't get out of your head. Maybe it's an ad jingle, maybe it's a pop song or a film score. Tell me your perennial earworm, because with me is Dr. Paul Harrison, Head of Consumer Behaviour at Deakin University. He joins me fortnightly for our segment, Buyer Beware. Paul, I need to know the science behind why for the last 30 years I've had peaches and apricots in my head.
Peaches and apricots? I don't even know. Can you sing me a few bars?
I should have known I was walking straight into it. Peaches, it's the Goulburn Valley. It's the Goulburn Valley.
Oh, okay. A bit like my dad picked the fruit that goes to...
That one
you
too.
You know what I'm talking about.
That's the one.
Yep. And there was a telephone number that stuck in my head as well for a pizza place as well.
Yep. We've got that one too.
Yep. And all of the listeners are now going to be repeating them as earworms throughout the day. It's called involuntary musical imagery. It's actually not about liking the song. It's actually about how the brain handles memory fragments. And usually what happens is it's kind of tied to what's called the default mode network, the brain's background processing system. What that means is that, and I think we've talked about this on the show before, it's that kind of shower thoughts thing. It actually works best when we're cognitively underloaded. So like when you're walking or showering or when you're stressed or fatigued, or basically the more that you've been exposed to that song. And it's built around not necessarily rational decision making, but it goes into that emotional limbic processing system and it just gets stuck in the memory system. And part of it is because there is a repetition about it, that it's familiar, that it's based on structures in Western music that just feel familiar. And that's what really makes jingles so powerful.
So there's a couple of things I want to pick out there. One is the structures of Western music. But before we get to that, you talked about taking it out of the rational part of your brain. Is that why music is powerful in advertising? It's because it's bypassing rational decision making?
Exactly. And it goes straight to the emotional system, the limbic system. And we've kind of seen that in research, is that people feel music before they understand it. And that's really critical. And, you know, if we're thinking about what then motivates behaviour, part of that is this idea that all of our behaviour, despite what we'd like to tell ourselves, is an emotional response. And then it's kind of build this process around it that feels rational. So, yeah, it goes straight to our emotions. And we feel that when we hear a song, we have an emotional response before we have a rational response. And a lot of it is actually built around the way that the music is structured and written. Part of it is about history and culture, the way that we've kind of been introduced to music. Context is everything, as we're learning in this segment every fortnight. Mm-hmm. You know, where we are when we experience this. And this is why a song can suddenly just kind of grab your heart and make you cry or make you laugh or make you feel something. And, you know, Qantas, for example, have used a particular song for a long time and people just feel something, even though it's a Peter Allen song that was written, 30 years ago or something, and was not written for that airline.
So this is kind of the heart of the Gruen transfer, not just an ABC TV show, but an actual phenomenon in marketing.
Yeah, it's interesting because the Gruen transfer, people kind of got used to the Gruen transfer as this television program, but actually it's the shift that we make when we walk into a particular environment and it shifts our thinking. It removes what we would call our rational processing. And it is built around this idea partly of ego depletion, not that idea of, you know, like my ego is bad, but the idea that when we are overwhelmed by stimuli, we make decisions based predominantly on emotional responses. And that's what happens when you walk into a big shopping mall. You have this Gruen transfer where you're overwhelmed by stimuli, where you are more likely to start buying things based on how you're feeling rather than what you're necessarily thinking. And this is, it's been demonstrated many, many times. Now, there is elements of this that kind of influence it. We call them moderators. But in reality, if we're overwhelmed, if we have significant stimuli, lighting, sound, music, all of these kinds of things, it does fire up those emotional processes, and that we're more likely to do things like spend more money, make decisions that feel right in the moment, those kinds of things.
So you mentioned music is one of these things. You talked before about Western music and this sort of familiarity or the language of music as being part of what's going on here.
Yeah, it's interesting because we are part of a Western culture, most of us. Even in non-Western cultures, they've been exposed to Western music. We kind of use that as the foundation. If you go back and listen to probably the late Romantic, early 20th century music, that pretty much sits as the foundation of most of our pop music now. And it's really very basically structured. Often it's built around two or three chord structures. There's some excellent examples of pop songs that just work so well because they're built around that. Even film music is built around that same structure. And it is, if you look at the way that somebody like Ed Sheeran or a jingle is made, it really is based on really four components. One of them is familiarity, which is just familiarity with the structure, not challenging people too much. Repetition. So repetition is things happening over and over again, things like verse, chorus, but then that idea of circularity, that it kind of keeps on coming back to the same thing. And then you have tension and release. And that's really important in all music. It's that kind of thing of building something up and then it's released. And these all feed into the human condition. Now, if you go and listen to really kind of what we would call art music, part of the reason why it's really hard to get into is because sometimes in some pieces, like a Wagner opera, it takes 16 hours for that tension to be released. And so you have to have that commitment. But most pop songs, most jingles are usually 30 seconds or so. And music, pop songs, are usually 3.5 minutes to 4 minutes. So it's enough to have a little bit of tension and then a little bit of release. And then you have this magic that's put on top of it. And then you have some lyrics that make sense to the target market.
You are listening to Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking to Dr. Paul Harrison, Head of Consumer Behaviour at Deakin University, about earworms. And you're telling me the earworms that you've had in your head for decades. Anne says Louis the Fly for the insect spray. Kelly's a happy little Vegemite and also likes aeroplane jelly. Well, Paul, you are uniquely placed to talk about earworms. You are not only an expert on why we buy things, you're also an opera singer from a past life who studied music composition at university. So what then is the ultimate recipe for a catchy earworm?
Well, I think we've talked about some of those ultimate jingles because they continue to hang around. I think there are some really good examples that I was thinking about this when I was thinking about the show, and I was thinking, what's a really good pop song, for example? I was thinking Billie Eilish and Phineas. They are very good at creating pop songs because they use this very simple structure. It's a 4-to-6 note hook. It's this idea of a kind of rhythmic identity. Birds of a Feather, I think, is a brilliant pop song just because it's circular, it's repetitive, it gives you that little bit of tension and then it gives you that release. It Ain't Over Till It's Over, the Lenny Kravitz song, is another great example of a pop song that really works. Now, the thing is, this is not to everybody's taste, and you know, we know that, but I think one of the things is that it becomes familiar. And even in jingles, you know, basically if I was to write the perfect jingle, and I have written some jingles for different brands and things like that, the difficulty is that you are constrained by a few things. One of them is you've only got 30 seconds. You can't be clever. You can't be too clever. You've actually got to have the brand name in there. And if it's a weird brand name, it's really hard to get in. And then it's got to be culturally relevant. And I think one great example of that the listeners might be familiar with is Dumb Ways to Die, which is, again, that same circularity. It's a little bit of humour. It was matched with, you know, the animation. But then it went on actually to be a song that people kind of can sing along. And I think all of those things together basically create the perfect jingle.
When we're talking about the perfect jingle and you're sort of outlining how formulaic it is, it really feels like this is an area that is ripe for AI to step in, because there's only so many ways to reshake this collection of chords.
Yeah, and I think that particularly in commercial music, particularly in and what I mean by commercial music is popular music and things like that, we will start to see AI starting to be able to better replicate I guess, the human experience. One of the complexities here is that, and we kind of know this in terms of creativity, is that people, if they know that something is being created by AI, they're less likely to kind of respond positively to it. But the issue with AI, and we're seeing this already, is that it's efficient, it's very productive, it can be hyper-targeted. You can basically do what they call A-B testing. So in artificial intelligence, they can create pretend audiences and based on profiles and segments and things like that. And then they can test different versions of a song or different versions of an ad campaign in those different processes. In the past, we'd have to go out to real humans. Mm. And 2 years ago, I remember I was at one of the consulting groups and they're going, yeah, we're doing A-B testing all the time with made up humans. I think there's difficulties there because humans are complex. We all know that, and that's what Life Matters is about. but I think that's the thing, is that we're, in a way, it's return on investment. If you can get a large language model or a music model to actually, or a neural network to develop a song, and it only costs, I don't know, $500 as opposed to $1,500, businesses will start to move towards that. And while, you know, me being a musician and a composer and also a consumer behavior academic, but that's my other job. One of these things is that it is quite scary to think that at some point that particular genre, that field, will be taken over by technology, and we have to start thinking about what, I don't know, barriers we need to put in place or what protections we need to put in place for creative people.
Paul, thank you so much for joining me. Dr. Paul Harrison is Head of Consumer Behavior at Deakin University, joins me fortnightly for our segment Buy Beware. And thank you for sending in jingles that you love. Anne has texted in a YouTube link for the decimal currency jingle. She says, I promise I don't sing this on repeat, but this is the first jingle I heard as a kid, a government jingle, no less. I will be checking that out as soon as this program finishes. Joanne Sale has sent in the recipe for a burger that starts with two all beef patties. I think you know the rest. Another says, any Tasmanian over 50 can still tell you the phone number for Tasmanian carpet cleaners. The jingle was stupid yet catchy. Well, on the power of jingles, there has been a really fantastic ABC podcast series that was actually hosted by Dee Madigan, who you spoke to earlier in the show. It's called Where the Bloody Hell Were You on the ABC Rewind channel. So if you go to ABC Listen and search for ABC Rewind, look for Where the Bloody Hell Were You, hosted by Dee Madigan. It's really worth a listen. You're with Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. Earlier in the program, you were part of a conversation unpacking whether zero alcohol drinks are as harmless as they seem. Here is one of Australia's favourite advertising executives, Dee Madigan's analysis on the way zero alcohol branding can impact different eyeballs.
I think they're seeing an opportunity for expanding their market and to be able to advertise legitimately. And unlike vapes, which I absolutely think tobacco companies used and then sold as an alternative to get people to stop smoking, but we knew it acted as a gateway, I think we are in danger of, regardless of their intent, that the unintended consequences on teenagers might be problematic. So we want the harm reduction benefits. We do not want to be creating a new marketing channel. And we know that's how branding works.
That's Dee Madigan chatting to me earlier in the show. I do recommend going back and listening to that full chat. Just search for Life Matters in ABC Listen. Thank you so much for your texts today. On zero alcohol drinks, Kathy says, I've stopped drinking alcohol and mainly drink sparkling water. On occasions, I choose non-alcoholic drinks from a supermarket. I like that I don't have to go to a bottle shop to buy them. I imagine people trying to stop drinking alcohol might not like to go into a bottle-o either. Another says, early initiation to alcohol exists and has always existed in our drinking culture. So why aren't we focused on education and making sure kids know what it does to you? I don't get why you're having this conversation on zero alcohol, says one person. Many of my friends opt for zero alcohol beverages for health benefits, and they've really helped wean problem drinkers off their nightly fix. Good point. The new research out today is the reason why we're talking about this today. Well, that is almost all I've got time for with you today here on Life Matters, coming to you from Jagera and Turrbal land. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk about O Week. It's underway in universities across Australia. What does the student experience look like for uni students in 2026? What do students need from a uni to get the most out of their education? And I want to know about your memories from your uni days, the good and the bad. I'll be taking your calls after 9 a.m. tomorrow. Plus, AI literacy. Is putting the onus on us as individuals to be AI literate enough, or do we need a bigger, more structural fix? That's tomorrow on Life Matters. I'll catch you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.